All right, so Genesis 37, it's taking place towards the end of Jacob's life. At this point, Jacob is a guy who has tried to find his value and significance in basically everything that you can try to find your value and significance in. He tried to find it in his parents. That didn't work out for him because he ended up being favored by his mother and not his dad. And he craved the approval of his father. He never got it. So he deceived his dad, and that ended up getting him kicked out of the house. So then he fled. He ran away. He found a girl. So he thought, maybe I'll find my significance in a woman. And he started hanging out with this girl, and he ended up getting kind of screwed over by her dad. So he ends up with four wives instead of just one, which he intended. And he kind of ruins that relationship as a result of having multiple wives. So that really didn't work out for him. Then he tried to find his fulfillment through being a businessman, but then he ended up getting screwed over by his boss, which a lot of us could relate to, right? So he realized that's not the way. So now he's back, and his favorite wife, Rachel, so he had four wives, he had 12 kids, at least 12 sons with those four wives. He had a couple daughters, but they're not mentioned. And within those 12 sons, one of them, two of them, should I say, were birthed by his favorite wife, Rachel. And the second one that was birthed was named Benjamin, and he was actually, Rachel died in birthing Benjamin. And so Jacob is kind of out of options. God has been trying to instill in him the idea that, man, I am the only one that's going to be there for you. I'm the only one that's going to take care of you. You need to look to me. I'm the one who loves you. But Jacob just keeps trying to find his value in the world, which is what we're going to do our entire lives as well. That's why I like Jacob's story so much. Because we have to remember when we're going through the Bible, we sometimes read stories of these people and we assume that they just got it, you know? They found God and God chose them and he called them out of the depths of despair and miry clay, and all of a sudden they became perfect and they became these stained glass saints. And that's not true. When you look at Jacob's life, you see a dude who struggled all the time, constantly fell, constantly went back to trying to find his value in other things than God, constantly fell to idolatry. And as a result of his sin, ruined his family. He really did. But did God love Jacob? Yeah, God loved Jacob. Did God choose Jacob? Yeah, he chose Jacob. And that's a really cool thing for me to always remember in my life, because I'll always have moments where, you know, I'll start ruining a relationship, or I'll start ruining parts of my ministry. I'll make huge mistakes and I'll think like, man, like, dude, I don't know if God is for me. You know, I don't even know if I'm really saved. And then I'll read about Jacob and I'll be like, yeah, if he was saved, I'm pretty sure I was saved too. You know, like I haven't had a couple kids that have massacred 300 people, you know, one day, you know, like he did. So I think I'm all right. You know, it encourages me because it reminds me, I know I'm chosen because God is faithful, not because I am. Right? That is the stasis of our position before God. It is based on his faithfulness towards us, not our faithfulness towards him, because we will fail. And Jacob, now he's turned to the last vestige of hope, his kids, which is what most people do, right? Most people in our world will turn to their children in order to find their satisfaction and their worth. They do it in several ways. There's a lot of ways you can do it. You could either spoil your kids and try to find your sustenance through them needing you. Or you could try to live vicariously through your children, raising them up and putting standards on them and putting goals in their heart and saying, you should do this or you should do that, and really pushing their kids into careers that maybe their kids don't want to do because they want to live vicariously through their children. There are many, many ways that we could do it. And I don't have kids yet, but I can guarantee you that when I do have kids, I'll probably fail to a couple of those, at least. Because I've seen how I am. I've seen how my heart is in my life, and I know that I have this deep tendency to try to find my sustenance in other people. And Jacob is no exception to this rule. He takes his son Joseph and he makes him his favorite. He makes him his favorite. And I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a spoiler alert. We're not going to get to these sections until probably 2 weeks from now when we meet back up after Easter. But what ends up happening? You guys have probably heard this story. Jacob favors Joseph. He ends up giving him the coat of many colors, right? He ends up, which we'll talk about in a second. He ends up giving him the coat of many colors. Joseph is the favorite. His brothers hate him. So his brothers conspire together. They end up selling him into slavery. Joseph then goes to Egypt. He becomes a slave in Egypt. He works at his master's house. He ends up getting screwed over there. He goes to jail for a little bit. Then finally, he's able to interpret some dreams And one of the dreams he's able to interpret is that of the pharaohs himself, the king of Egypt. And he interprets this dream that there is a great famine coming, a famine that is going to be so severe, it's going to, if left unchecked, it's going to kill everybody in the entire area of Mesopotamia. It's going to kill all the Israelites. It's going to kill his family. It's going to kill all of Egypt. It's going to kill everybody. And he said the only way to avert this crisis is Joseph receives this vision. He receives this warning from Pharaoh. And he says the only way that we're going to be able to stop this is if we start saving up food now. We're going to have 7 years of prosperity. We got to start saving up food right now. And if you don't do it, then we're all going to die. And so Pharaoh believes Joseph. He sets Joseph in charge. He becomes second to Pharaoh. And because of that, Joseph ends up saving the entire known world. Right? And if Joseph wouldn't have done this, God has already said that his plan for his promised Messiah is going to come through Jacob. It's going to come through Israel. And if Joseph wouldn't have done this, if he wouldn't have been put in this position, the entire world would have died because there would have been no Messiah. Right? So God doesn't just save the Middle East, which is impressive, but he literally saved everybody. He saved the entire world through Joseph, through this messed up family dynamic. And what this chapter is really going to show us is it's going to show us something that's really cool. The Bible shows it to us in a lot of different sections, but we just don't see it because we're not looking for it. And it's how does God work through his hiddenness? There are certain sections of the Bible where God is clearly, if you read it in the Bible, you're aware that, man, God is moving powerfully, right? And in that story that I just told you guys, you'd be like, man, God must be moving powerfully in this family. God's name is really not going to be mentioned almost at all in the next couple chapters. He's not going to talk to anyone. Pretty much no one's going to talk to him. And yet, all the while, he's setting up the situation that's going to save the entire world. There's a couple books like this. One of my favorites is Esther. Esther is a book that God's name is not mentioned once. Not once. And yet, through Esther, God saved all of his people. Right? The Bible does this every now and then. The Bible gives us a story where God is seemingly absent to show us how God actually moves and guides. Because a lot of times, like I said, we could read through the Bible and we could read stories like of Jacob where he's like encountering God at a mountain and, you know, angels are ascending and descending on a ladder. You know, we read stories of David where he goes and he prays to God and God shows up and talks to him. And we're like, that's what I'm talking about. Why can't I have a relationship with God like that, you know, where I pray and God just shows up. And he just tells me what to do. That would be the best. And you know what? God sometimes does lead that way. But most often, he doesn't. Most often, God leads through his hiddenness. And actually, God is going to do far more in his hiddenness in this chapter than he has done previously in Jacob's life through his presence. He's going to do infinitely and abundantly more. So let's start reading this chapter and we'll start figuring out why God does it through his hiddenness and what exactly he is doing. This is verse 1 of chapter 37. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him, and they could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf rose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." He told to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, and his father kept this matter in mind. Now, in these first couple verses, what we're seeing is we're seeing how Jacob has totally ruined this family dynamic through his favoritism of Joseph. he's not only ruined himself because he's looking to Joseph to find his satisfaction, which only God can give him, but he's ruined his other sons because now they feel like they don't matter because their dad is favoring one child above the others. You remember that Joseph receives this coat of many colors. Some of your translations may say that it's richly adorned. Some may say that it had long sleeves. We just don't know. We really don't know. There's been so many different speculation because we have no clue what it means. What we know for sure is that whatever this cloak was, whatever it looked like, is not really important. The important thing is what it represented, right? What it represented was Jacob favored Joseph more than anyone else. He looked at Joseph, that was his idol. That was his everything. And so it ruins the brothers because notice four times the writer of Genesis mentions that his brothers hated Joseph. They hated him. And because of that, they're also, in a way, they're growing bitter towards their father. Now, how does it ruin Joseph? A lot of us miss this. But Joseph is, once again, he's not a perfect guy. He's not a perfect guy. And at age 17, he is turning into a spoiled, rotten brat. He's nearing being a sociopath. How do we know? Notice, he has this dream. He has no idea, by the way. He doesn't say, God gave me this dream. He doesn't say, God spoke to me. He just said, I had a dream, right? Not like Martin Luther King. He just had a dream. He just had a random dream about people bowing down to him. And if anyone said that to me, I'd be like, you're kind of an arrogant jerk, right? You know, and that's what his brothers are thinking in their minds. They're like, you're kind of an arrogant jerk. You know, if I had a dream at night that my brothers were bowing down and worshiping me, and I didn't know for a certainty it came from God, I best keep that to myself, right? I best not say anything. But Joseph, he walks up and he's like, hey guys, I had a dream last night. They already hate him. They already hate him. And he says it anyway. He just keeps going like, Joseph, we hate you. All right, so here's my dream, right? And he goes into it. And they hate him and they're seething. And you know what he does? He has a second dream. What does he do? He goes to them again. Which means that Joseph is becoming so spoiled. He's becoming so much of a person that is into himself and proud and arrogant that he doesn't care about how his actions are affecting other people. To put it another way, this is a young man who has no idea about actions and consequences. He thinks he's above it. He thinks he could do whatever he wants, which is what spoiling a kid does to them, right? You spoil your kid, they grow up and they think, I could do whatever I want. You know, you can't talk to me that way. You know, no one can control me. I have my own life. I can do what I want, right? That comes from being spoiled. That's where Joseph is at. His life is being ruined. His life is being ruined by his father, whether he knows it or not. And so this entire family dynamic is crumbling at the seams because of what Jacob has done. And this is the first reason of why God must work through his hiddenness in this family. If God were to have showed up at this point and been like, Joseph, you're spoiled and you're a jerk. Stop it, you know? Brothers, you're hateful, you're vindictive, you're also murderous. You need to stop. Jacob, you're spoiling your kids. You're ruining your family dynamic. Cut it out, right? If God would have done that, would it have really changed anyone? Would it have really changed anyone for God to have done that? And the answer is no, because here's the truth. The truth about your life, the truth about my life. I cannot be told my sin. I have to be shown my sin. And that is why God is the best father. He really is. He's the best dad. If you're ever wondering, why doesn't God talk to me all the time? Here's why God doesn't talk to you all the time. If you're praying for situations, you're like, why isn't God answering me? Why isn't God telling me what to do? Why isn't God correcting me when I make mistakes? Here's the truth. The truth is that you're proud. And if God were just to answer you, you would hate it. You don't think you'd hate it, but deep down you'd hate it. Because here's the thing, when God talks to you, is this a suggestion? Right? If you say, God, what should I do with my life? And if God says, this is what you should do with your life, that's not a suggestion. That's a, you do this or you're walking in sin. And so a lot of us were like, I would just love for God to just tell me what to do. If God told you what to do all the time, you would feel like you were trapped. You'd feel like you have no free will and no options. You would feel like you have to do these things or else God's going to be angry with you. It would ruin your life if God did that to you. If every single time you were about to do something wrong, if God stepped in and said, stop it, You know, I might like it to a certain extent, but after a while I'd be like, you know, I don't have the freedom to do anything. I don't have the freedom to make mistakes. I mean, is this really wrong? God, how do I even know that this is wrong for me to do? Right? Joseph, deep in his heart, if God would have come to him and been like, you're spoiled, Joseph, he would have been like, I'm not spoiled, God. You know, so I, you know, talk down to my brothers every now and then, but they're nincompoops, you know, and so it's okay for me to do this. And the brothers would have been in their hearts, they'd be like, you don't know what kind of guy this is, God. This is a jerk. You know, he needs to be told his place. And the dad, once again, would be like, well, I just like Joseph more. I mean, what's wrong with that? You know, I love all of my sons. I just like Joseph a little bit more. I mean, is that a wrong thing? Am I not supposed to love? Right? By God coming down and talking to these people, it wouldn't have done any good. The only way that they're going to realize exactly what they're doing is if they're shown. And the only way to be shown is through pain. This is what good parents do. Okay, good parents don't come to you and say, do this. Do it. You know, and you're like, well, I don't know why I should do it. Because I said so. Do it. You know, and they force you to do it your entire life. That's not what a good parent does. Because that's not teaching you how to be a functioning adult. That's not teaching you how to make up your own mind, consider actions versus consequences, and be able to make decisions. That's not a good parent. A good parent also doesn't look at your life and say, do what you want. I don't care. You know, make up your own mind. Sometimes they'll say that to five-year-olds. Make up your mind. I don't know. You know, I don't know what's best for you. You want Cheerios for dinner? Yeah, what? I don't know. You know, like, do it yourself. You know, that's also not a good parent. Because as a young child, you don't know what's best for you. Here's what a good parent does. A good parent sets rules, but then allows you the freedom to break them. And then allows natural consequences to proceed from those rules. You guys get that? So here's what a good parent does. Okay, let's say I am 16 years old and I go to my mom and I say, Mom, I want to drop out of high school. A good parent, right, there's two roles of bad parents, right? The first bad parent would say, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You will never drop out of high school. If you drop out of high school, I will disown you as a child. You're going to be out of the house on your own. There's no way you're going to do that. Right? That's the first bad parent. The second bad parent would be like, well, do what you want. Yeah? I mean, who am I to know what's best for you? You know, you drop out. You know, maybe it'll work out great for you. Right? That's the second bad parent. Here's what a good parent does. They look at you and say, look, this is why you shouldn't. I disagree with your decision. This is why you shouldn't do it. This is what's going to happen to you if you do it. You have to realize this. If you want to do this, it's fine, but this is the consequences you're going to have to deal with for the rest of your life if you make this decision. Right? And if you do it, they say, hey, I'm still your parent, I still love you, but you're going to have to deal with your consequences. I'm not going to handle them for you. I'm not going to make up for them for you. If you make this decision, you know, you're going to have to work, you're going to have to make your own decisions, you're going to have to live your life, because I can't support you in what you're doing. I love you, I'm always your parent, but I can't support this decision. Do you guys get that? And then they allow the consequences to happen to you. So now, instead of someone just telling you, you shouldn't do it, now, after you've done it, you realize, yeah, I really shouldn't have done that. That was a really bad move. And now you realize for yourself that you made a mistake. That's what God does to us. He tells us, you shouldn't do this. They're like, but God, I really want to. He's like, okay, go do it. And then when you do it, he's there and he says, do you see now why I said this? Do you see that I was looking out for you when I said not to? And he helps you out. That's what a good parent does. Which is why a lot of people, you know, some people will tell me, you know, I'm trying to make this decision, and I just need to pray about it. I just need to pray about it. Sometimes I'll tell people, you need to stop praying. Now, that sounds very unbiblical, but this is why. They're praying about something for which they know the answer. And you pray about something for which you know the answer, you're not looking for God's word, you're looking for your word through God's mouth. Let me give you a great example biblically. Numbers chapter 22. There was a guy named Balaam, and God told him specifically, do not go work for this king, Balak. He's wicked, he's evil, he's out to get my people. If you go work for him, I'm going to be mad at you. And so Balaam's like, right on, God, I'm not going to do it. Then Balak, the evil king, he sends people over to Balaam and they're like, hey, dude, like, why don't you come work for our king? You know, we'll give you some money. And Balaam's like, oh, I shouldn't do it. You know, God told me not to. They're like, we'll give you half the kingdom. And he's like, let me go confer with God again. Maybe I didn't hear that right. You know, maybe God, you know, stuttered or something like that. And he's like, God, you know, I know you said no, but they're offering me this amount of money. You know, is it still a no? You know, and so, and God actually tells him, go ahead, Balaam, go ahead and do it. Okay, now why was his prayer hypocritical? Because he already what? He already had made up his mind. He'd already made up his mind. He was just wanting God to affirm his decision. A lot of times when I'm talking to people, they'll be doing something that's clearly wrong. I'll be like, look, dude, this is what the Bible says. It's clearly wrong. And they'll be like, well, let me pray about it. No need to pray about it. You know it's wrong. That's always, you know, when Mormons talk to me, they always say that to me, and it kind of makes me laugh a little bit. I'll like show them through the Bible of how their book is wrong and against the Bible, and they'll be like, well, why don't you pray about it? Like, I don't think I need to pray about it. You know, like, I mean, I'm pretty sure that God's pretty clear. I mean, what would God say to me? He'd be like, hey, ignore my word. Ignore my Bible and believe the Book of Mormon. You know, I know it says this, but I was drunk that day. You can't hold me accountable for what I wrote in Isaiah. You know, like, dude, that was a long time ago, man. You know, like, this is totally different. You know, God's never going to do that. When God says something, he means it. When God told Jacob, dude, I am your God. I am where you're going to find peace. You're not going to find it anywhere else. Jacob could pray about that all he wants, but it's not going to change God's mind. Right? So you can make your own decisions. You can go against God if you want, but there will be consequences, and you have to be aware of that. These are the consequences that are happening to the family. And as we go through these chapters, everyone in this family is going to learn from these consequences, which is really cool. They're all going to learn their lesson through God's hiddenness, not through his presence. Verse 12. And his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said, here I am. Then he said to him, please go and see if it is well with all your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him out in the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. So this is once again Jacob just being an idiot. He's just a huge fool in this section. Okay, he already knows that his sons hate Joseph, right? They already hate him. He's the youngest. He's one of the youngest, should I say. Now, what is the number one way that you could really stick it to the brothers? How about putting the youngest, who they hate, in charge? How about making him the manager? And Jacob's like, no, that's not going to be a problem. Joseph, why don't you go check up on your brothers, you know? Like, you go manage them, it'll be fine, you know? I can't see anything going wrong here. He's just delusional. He's so deluded, because that's what happens to us when we idolize something. Marcel Proust, who was a French philosopher, she said it this way. She said, you do not fall in love with people, you fall in love with your ideals of people. What we're talking about is that in my life, I like to think that everybody sees things my way. And so because of that, when I love people, I tend to think that they are seeing things my way. So Jacob's looking at Joseph, and he's like, how could anyone not love the guy? You know, he's awesome. He's Joseph. He's got the cool coat, you know, he's walking around, he's my boy, you know, how could anyone hate Joseph? When in reality, there's a lot of good reasons for them to hate Joseph. And he just doesn't see it, he doesn't realize it because he's living in delusion. Now Joseph goes, he's faithful because, once again, Joseph's kind of an idiot, right? Joseph's walking around, he doesn't understand consequences, he doesn't understand that anything bad could happen to him. So he goes out and he looks for his brothers, and he says, in verse 15, now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? He said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flock. And the man said, they have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to him, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him in some pit. We shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hands and said, let's not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of his hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that he was on him. Then they took him and cast him in the pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal, because nothing like betraying your brother to death that works up a good appetite. You know what I mean? You're like, man, all that betrayal and murder, man, makes me really hunkering for a meal. You know, so they start eating, which I think is just, it just shows how wicked they are. You know, just how, like, how much they don't even, there's no like, oh my gosh, what have we done? You know, like, we need to rethink this, guys. They're just like, hey, dude, let's eat some food. You know, that was fun. You know, and they like start eating lunch. And it actually, you don't get it here, but later on, when they're reminiscing about this story in Egypt, they say that Joseph was crying. He was crying. So it's not that they're just eating, you know, a meal and Joseph's just like saying, come on, guys, you know, let me out. The joke's over, you know, let me out. Like, it says that they stripped him of his cloak. And that, in the Hebrew, it's a violent word. It's the word that's usually used when you skin an animal. So when they're saying they stripped, they're not saying like, hey, give me your cloak, man. All right, get in there. You know, they like threw him in there. It's like, dude, they ripped it off of him. They beat him. They threw him in the pit. He's down there. He's naked in the darkness and the blackness. And he's just crying. He's like, guys, please don't let me die down here. And they're just like eating like, ha ha, you know, that sucker. And they're just like eating food. They're digging it. So it just shows just how unbelievably hardened towards anger and bitterness these guys are. And it says, then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened, and the Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelite for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben turned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So you remember, Reuben was the one that was kind of fighting for Joseph, right? He was fighting for Joseph. And you get this idea, you're like, maybe Reuben's not that bad of a guy, you know? Reuben's the firstborn. You know, maybe he's a good guy. Maybe he really does care about his brother, his little bro. But here you see, who is he really concerned about? Himself. He's like, dude, I know that dad loves this dude. I know that he loves this kid. If we kill him, even if we say an animal killed him, our dad will never forget this. It'll be torture to live with the guy, right? Let's not do this. Let's get him out of there. And now they sold him for money. And this is, by the way, this is kind of an aside. We've talked about this before, but if you ever want to really understand the Bible's view of something, you just go to the first time it's mentioned. This is the first time the Bible mentions slavery. So you guys know. Now, in this context of them selling Joseph for money, receiving money from him, for kidnapping him, for stripping him of his cloak, and everything like that, how are they viewing Joseph? Do they see him as a human being? Do they see him with value and integrity? And they're like, man, this is great for him. They see him as less than human. They see him as someone that they wanted to kill. And they're selling him for nothing, right? They're just like, dude, yeah, let's not kill him. Let's get some money out of the guy, you know? I mean, if we kill him, we don't get nothing. They're offering us, you know, a couple, 20 shekels of silver is actually nothing to turn your nose up at. That was about, you know, maybe around $15,000 to $20,000 in modern day currency. So it's quite a profit from selling your brother out, you know? So they're just like, yeah, let's get some money out of the guy. So they sell him, and then he goes off and he ends up getting sold into Egypt. But what do? Operation cover-up, verse 31. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to the father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? And he recognized it, and he said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. A couple things I want to pull out of this section. We're going to wrap up in a second. But a couple things I want to pull out to you guys in this section of Scripture before we end. First thing I want to mention to you guys is Judah. We're going to talk about Judah next service in chapter 38. Judah is not only one of the children of Israel, but do you know, he is the direct ancestor of Jesus. He's a direct ancestor of Jesus. He is mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. He is always mentioned as being the person that David came from. In fact, Jesus, a lot of times, one of his titles is the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. So Jesus doesn't just talk about Judah. He's like, yeah, Judah, I guess, is my ancestor or something like that. But, you know, we all have nuts in our family tree, right? You know, he doesn't say it. He's like, dude, Judah is my ancestor, man. He's like proud of it. And after reading this story, we're like, Judah? This scumbag? the dude who is such a dirtbag that he's like, let's not kill Joseph. Let's sell him. You know, that's way better. Let's put him into a slavery for the rest of his life, a fate worse than death, and let him suffer forever so we can make a couple thousand, you know? That's the guy that Jesus is like, that's my great 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 grandfather, man. I am the Lion of the Tribe of that dude. You know, like, that's what he's saying to us when he talks about Judah. And once again, it just always shows, the Bible is always showing the power of the gospel. The power of the gospel is to take the most craven, the most wicked, the most cowardly, the most horrific human beings on this earth and turn them into something glorious by the power of God. And that's what Judah becomes. That Judah is not a byword for some dude who sucks and betrays his brother, but Judah is the byword of power, of might, of sustenance. And through this section, we're going to see, in the next chapter, we're going to see that how God works in Judah's life to make him the man that God can use. It's not where you start the race, right? It's not where you begin your life with Christ. It's where you end. This is where Judah starts. He is a dirtbag at this point. But God works in this guy mightily and through a lot of pain and through a lot of consequences, and he actually becomes a pretty decent dude at the end of his life, which is surprising. The next thing that I want you guys to see is Jacob. Now, losing a son, I can imagine. I've been at a couple of funerals where a parent has lost their child, and they have been the roughest funerals I've ever been to. You know, when a child loses their parent, depending on the age of the child, those are always rough. They're always painful, but nothing compares to hearing a dad or a mom sit up on and talk about their children in their eulogy. It's one of the most powerful, it's one of the most painful things that I've ever witnessed. And I couldn't imagine how painful it would be for Jacob to endure this. But if you notice, Jacob does the normal mourning, right? That's what was supposed to happen today. He does the normal mourning. But it insinuates that he does the normal mourning, which usually lasted months, by the way. So it's not like, you know, he just, you know, he heard the news and then his sons are like, hey, dude, get over it, you know? He mourned for months over Joseph. And it says that they actually tried to come and comfort him. So they actually came to him. They realized, oh my gosh, like, you know, our dad really loved Joseph. This is crazy. You know, what have we done? And they start to regret it a little bit, what they did. And they try to comfort him. And he says, but he refused to be comforted. He refused to be comforted. He refused to receive any amount of consolation from anyone. And what it shows is it shows that we as Christians, yes, we're called to love people. We're called to love people as Christ loves us. But Jacob hasn't loved Joseph. He has lusted after Joseph. And this section proves it. Right? Someone dies in their life and they go into grief, they go into depression, but eventually they get out of it. Some people lose someone in their life and they kill themselves. Right? Some people lose their jobs and they're in grief, they're in depression, but then they get out of it, they recover, and they're able to move on. Some people lose their jobs and they jump off a building. And the question is, what's the difference? What's the difference between those two people? Both people endured the same amount of suffering, yet one person killed themselves and the other person recovered. What's the difference there? The difference is, where is their hope? Where's their hope? If my job is important to me and I love it and I love the work that I do, if I lose it, it will hurt me, but it won't destroy me. I'll be able to recover if I have hope in something greater. If my hope is my job, though, once it's taken away, all my reason for life has been taken away with it. Jacob becomes a shell of a man after this. He doesn't take his own life, but he becomes an absolute shell of a man. He does not recover ever. Until he finally sees Joseph again. And he becomes an even worse father than he was. Because in the brothers' mind, what did they probably think would happen after Joseph died? What did they think would happen? What would Jacob maybe do to them? Maybe he would love them, right? Maybe he would treat them better. They're like, dude, now that Joseph's out of the way, this scumbag, you know, now you could see how great we are as kids. And it shows just how they're messed up too. Because who should they have been mad at? Should they have really been mad at Joseph? No, they should have been mad at Jacob. Joseph didn't have a choice. It's not like Joseph made Jacob favor him. Jacob's the one that made the decision to favor Joseph. And yet they don't hate their father. They're, in a weird way, they're infatuated with their dad. And they're still craving affection from their dad. Right? Where they should have been like, dude, what a jerk. You know, why is he favoring this one kid and not us? Why can't he look at us the same way that he looks at Jacob? And they should have just ignored the guy. But instead, they're infuriated at their brother. And this happens all the time. I talk to people all the time, whether it's this. Sometimes I talk to maybe a girl or sometimes a man, and they've been cheated on, right? Their spouse or their boyfriend, their girlfriend, whatever. They cheated on them. And they'll be like, you know, I'm mad at this person for cheating on me. Don't get me wrong. But they're more upset with the person that they cheated on them with. And I'm like, why are you more upset with this person? Isn't that a little bit weird? And at the bottom of their heart, the reason why they're more upset with that person, because in their mind, what are they thinking? Whose fault is it? It's that person. They seduced them. That's the problem. That's the issue. They seduced them, and that's why it happened. And if they weren't in the picture, our relationship would be great. We would have the best relationship ever if that person didn't come in. But is that true? No. Or I'll talk to people, they're grown up, you know, you think that, you know, they're 30, 40, sometimes 50 years old. And you think that there's no way that someone, their parents favoring another sibling would still be impacting them. But you know what it does? It never goes away. And they're just so bitter at their brother or their sister. For years, they've held bitterness in their heart, for years, decades even, over their brother and their sister. And I'm like, why are you so mad at them? And what did this person do to you? So, well, they, you know, they were always the favorite. They were always this. They were always that. Is that their fault? You know, did they do that? Did they hypnotize your parents? Did they put a weird mind trip on them? No. Okay. So whose fault is it really? It's your parents, right? You need to look at things the way that they actually are. And the reason why we don't look at things the way they actually are is because secretly in their hearts, they're looking for their satisfaction. They're looking for their joy where? In their parents, right? Or in their spouse, or wherever else. They're certainly not looking for it in God. That's their major goal, is to get right with that person and not with God. Not find their sustenance with Him. And that's unbelievably sad when people do that. That'll never heal in your heart. And I've seen it happen time and time and time again. Where kids, like I said, you think when you grow up, you think when you become an adult, it ends, but it's not. It's like the second they start hanging out with their parents again, they're bending over backwards to get the parents' approval. And I'm like, what happened? You know, why is it whenever you hang out with your dad, you act like this or you do that? Because deep down, they desperately want the approval of their parents. Even though they should be mad at their parents, but they're not. Because they don't see things correctly. The brothers do not see things correctly. But through this moment, through Joseph being killed, in quotation marks, they're seeing it's really not an issue with Joseph. It's an issue with who? Jacob. The dude is favoring a dead man over his live children. Right? That's jacked up, right? If a parent's like, dude, you know, if only you could be like Joseph. You're like, dude, Joseph's dead. He's like, I know, you know, and even in death, he's better than you. You know, even a dead guy is better than you guys. You know, it's just like, it's just reiterating to them to the idea that, you know what, the problem, the issue is my dad's heart. The issue is my dad's heart, and I need to realize that, and I need to seek something greater than him. And the brothers all realize it. Next thing that's really interesting about this is Joseph. We're going to be talking a lot more about Joseph next week, but here's the thing about Joseph. At this moment, Joseph has a choice. When something this terrible happens to you, which it is terrible, right? There's no getting around it. This is about as bad as it gets. To have your own brothers strip you naked, throw you in a pit, sell you into slavery, that's That's about as bad as it gets, right? At this point, he has a choice, though. He could either blame this situation for the rest of his life, or he can learn from the situation for the rest of his life. And those are the two options that all of us have, because you know what? Every single one of us in our lives, we're going to have terrible things occur to us. Every one of us. No one gets out of it. Nobody gets out of it. Subtly, in our own hearts, we'll always think that our suffering is somehow worse than other people's. I'll always be like, I don't really see other people struggling with this. Here's the deal. Everybody has issues. I was reading a book called The Scars That Have Shaped Me about a woman who, I've told you guys about this woman before. She's an amazing woman, amazing godly woman. Vanitha Risner is her name. But she's had polio. She was diagnosed with polio. She had to have, I think, something like 37 surgeries before she was 13. She walks with a huge limp. She's been this incredibly painful life. Had her one-year-old son die, in her arms. Had a marriage fall apart. Just intense amounts of suffering. And in her book, she says this: in my suffering, I would lessen other people's sufferings and think that somehow my life was harder than everybody else's. Now, for a woman like that to say that, I'm like, wow, that's kind of interesting. Because in my mind, I'm like, I think you have suffered worse than me. But she would say, no, I've just suffered differently than you. Everybody suffers. Everybody goes through times like this. They may not be to the extent of this, but everybody will go through a suffering that will feel like this. You'll feel like everything has been ripped away from you. You'll feel like you've been abandoned to die. You'll feel like nobody understands you. Everybody will go through this type of circumstance at least once in their life. And the choice that we're going to have, the choice that you have, the choice that I have, is, am I going to learn from this, or am I going to blame this? I could either walk with a limp for the rest of my life and just say, like, that's why my life sucks, because that happened to me, because my parents, never cared about me, or because my parents cared about me too much and spoiled me, or because of this, because of that. You could blame your parents, you could blame your society, you could blame your school, you blame your guidance counselor, you blame your uncle, you blame whoever you want to blame for the rest of your life, and your life will never get better because you, instead of learning from your circumstance, you let it defeat you. And the difference between Joseph, between what Joseph is going to do and what we do, is very simple, and it has to do with his cloak. You remember what the cloak was? The cloak he was given to Joseph. It was a symbol of Jacob's approval of Joseph. And the picture there is that it was ripped off. And that picture is so crazy to me. Because the reason why Joseph was spoiled, right? Why was Joseph so spoiled? It was because he was looking to who? His dad. The approval of his dad was everything to him, and he let it spoil him rotten. And his own brothers ripped it off of him. And this is symbolic. It's symbolic of something violently being ripped out of his life. The idols of every single one of these people has been ripped out of their lives violently, just like Joseph. And Joseph chooses to be clothed with a better cloak, to put it that way. Throughout the Bible, there's always this picture of clothing. It's happened all the way from Genesis 2 when we fell. When we started out naked, and then we made our own clothing out of shame. And ever since then, there's been this theme through the Bible that we need some sort of clothing to fix us. We need something to cover our shame, something to cover our guilt, something to cover our insecurities and our inadequacies. We need something better. We need some sort of a love or sign of affection from some greater figure in order to fix what's wrong with us. And Joseph's coat teaches us this lesson. You don't need the approval of your parents. You don't need the approval of your spouse. Who do you need? You need God. That's why, by the way, in the book of Revelation, chapter 19, it says that God is going to clothe us with new robes of white righteousness at the wedding supper of the Lamb. It's a really beautiful image. And what it's a picture of is you need that. That's what you need. You need to know that Jesus approves of you, that he loves you, that he cares about you, that you are favored, that you are loved, that you are adored. That's what you need inside of your life. You're never going to find it with anyone else. Because Joseph receives this greater cloak, he's able to learn from his experience and not let that experience destroy the rest of his life. But it's something that we need to learn how to do as well. If we don't, we will be destroyed. We'll be victims for the rest of our lives, and you're never going to recover. You're never going to get over it. You're always going to be blaming. And that's certainly not what God wants for us. The final thing that I want to share is actually in Proverbs chapter 30. When we talk about suffering, when we talk about this level of suffering, because there's things that from certain perspectives, like I said, we can understand, and there's things from other perspectives we can't. Like, for instance, if I live long enough, I will see my parents die one day. That's a fact. Right? They're going to die. I'm going to have to watch my dad and my mom die. And that's suffering. That's going to be suffering for me. It's going to hurt me a lot. But there's a vast difference between me watching my parents die and, say, what's happening right now in my family, where my brother-in-law, who's in his 30s, is going to die probably in a year. And he's got five kids, and his youngest is two. So there's the suffering that I'm going to endure one day of watching my parents die at a ripe old age. And there's the suffering that those kids are going to endure when they watch their dad die when they're too young to even process it. Does that make sense? There's levels of suffering that we can't wrap our minds around. And here's the thing. Proverbs 30 is going to talk about this. This is what he says. I am more stupid than any man. Verse 2 of Proverbs 30. I don't have the understanding of a man. I have neither learned wisdom nor have knowledge of the Holy One. For who has ascended into heaven or descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has bound the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name? And what is his son's name, if you know? Now, the dude who wrote this, Agur is his name, he says that he's dumber than anyone who's ever lived. And if you've read Proverbs 30, you're like, you're not dumber than anyone who's ever lived. Like, I read Proverbs 30, there's a lot of wisdom in there. This dude is bright. You know, he's smart. But what he's talking about is he's talking about these types of circumstances. He's talking about these types of circumstances that he's like, dude, I am no closer to understanding them than my dog. You know, they blow my mind. I do not understand why this had to happen. Right? Joseph could look at the situation and be like, God, I have no clue why this had to happen. Why this way? Why not some other way? Why not tell me? Why not prevent the famine in some different way? But if all these circumstances didn't happen exactly as they happened, Joseph would have remained spoiled, the brothers would have remained murderous, Jacob would have remained an idolater, and the entire world would have never found salvation. Everything in this story had to happen exactly the way it did in order for God's plan to come to fruition. But there is no way that any of them knew it at this moment. Does that make sense? The only way you could have known it is 6,000 years later reading it in a church. Right, that's the only way you could look at this story and be like, oh, I totally see what God's going through right now. You know? Because you know, why? Because you know the end. That's what Proverbs 30 is saying. He's saying, I don't get it. I'm stupid. I don't know. Why? Because I haven't ascended to heaven. I don't know. I don't see the whole picture. But there's someone who does. There's somebody who does, and I need to trust him. And this is what you and I have to do in our suffering. When the hiddenness of God is surrounding your life, and you don't know what's going on, and you're like, I don't understand why I'm in the circumstances that I'm in. This is what you got to know. Know that God is working, but don't think you know what he's up to. Okay? Know that God is working, but don't assume that you know what he's doing. Because I guarantee you, if you think you know what he's doing, he's going to prove you wrong pretty quickly. Right? Joseph could have been in that pit and be like, I think that God is trying to work on my selfishness, you know? So I'm going to learn from this. And if he would have thought that, if he would have thought that that was what God was doing, he would have been totally disappointed. Because the next time that he went into a house and he's like, yeah, I'm learning from my selfishness, he does the right thing. He learns from his selfishness, right? He does the right thing. He learns the lesson. You know what he does? You know what happens to him from doing the right thing? He's thrown in prison for years. So if he would assume this is what God's doing, he's working on my selfishness, when he got thrown in jail, he'd be like, I have no, God, you suck, you know, I hate you, I'm renouncing my faith. It would have totally ruined him. But little did he know, little would he have known that in jail, God was working on his plan to save everybody, including his family. Know God is working, but don't think you know what he's up to. When I look at the situation that's happening with my family right now, dude, I know that God's working. I know he's doing something. But I got no clue what it is. And I probably won't know in my entire life. Probably towards the end of my life, I'll get to see the teeniest fraction of what God intended to do through all this. But only God knows the whole story. We trust God. And at the end of that, remember what he said? What is his name and what is his son's name, if you know it? He points out the Son of God. Why? Because the Son of God demonstrates to us the truth of suffering. That through Jesus' suffering, the entire world was saved. I mean, do you see the parallels here? Right? Joseph, stripped naked by his brothers, cast into a pit to die. He cried out in despair. Nobody heard him. Nobody saved him. What happened to Jesus? Stripped by his brothers, crucified, cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And nobody came to help him. And through the sufferings of Jesus, all of us were saved. All of us were saved because of that. And because we have a God who suffers like we do, we can trust him with what he's doing. We know that he's working. We trust that he's working. But we just don't know what he's doing. Right? Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you for your word, for how it encourages us and strengthens us. And I pray no matter what season we're in, Lord, whether you feel very present to us or whether you feel incredibly distant to us, I pray that we would learn from this season. We would learn to trust you. We would learn to know that you are faithful and always, God, and you are always working a plan out, whether we see it or not. In your name, amen.